Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. On Sunday, May 5th, Chinese President Xi Jinping will begin his first trip to Europe in 5 years. During the trip, Xi will make a high-profile 2-day visit to France, where he's likely to encourage President Macron to continue pursuing an independent path from the United States when it comes to relations with Beijing. Xi will also make stops in Hungary and Serbia, both of which have cultivated close ties with China in recent years, despite calls for de-risking from the U.S. and other European leaders. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently returned from his visit to China, during which he met with Xi and other senior Chinese officials amid the context of the persistent simmering tensions between Washington and Beijing. What should we make of these two international trips, and what can they tell us about the current state of relations between China, Europe, and the U.S.? To discuss this and more, we're really pleased to have Noah Barkin and Bonnie Glaser with us on the podcast today. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
Quick backgrounds. Noah is a senior advisor with Rhodium Group's China practice, focusing on Europe-China relations and transatlantic China policy. And Bonnie is managing director of the German Marshall Fund's Indo-Pacific program.
All right. I also have a GMF hat.
And that's right. And your wonderful newsletter, which I always read.
Thanks.
Bonnie, let's start with you, actually, on the U.S.-China side of things. I want to start with your takeaways from Blinken's trip and what it tells us about the U.S.-China relationship, because I think it's really just the crucial backdrop against which we're thinking about the China-Europe relationship as well.
Well, Secretary Blinken went to China. This was his second trip after the balloon incident. And so the last one, which was immediately following the balloon incident, or when the Chinese decided to talk again to the United States several months later, that was a tough visit. That was a period, really, of very high tensions in U.S.-China relations. So here we are more than a year, or just under a year later, where Secretary Blinken is following through on some of the discussions that Xi Jinping had with President Biden when they met in San Francisco, called the Woodside Summit from last November. And of course, had a phone call just about a month ago. And the relationship is different today. There are communication mechanisms. There are some areas where the two countries are actually trying to cooperate. They are really, I think the Biden administration is testing the proposition that we can cooperate with China. And at the top of that list is the fentanyl problem in the United States, where the United States is trying to get the Chinese to stop shipping these precursor chemicals to Mexico that end up in fentanyl that's sold here in the U.S. And then I think the two other major issues really for Blinken in this trip was the overcapacity in China, so excess production that's being delivered to various countries around the world, and not just in Europe, not just the U.S., but apparently also Brazil has complained about this. And it's electric vehicles, of course, but it's lots of other things. China produces 1/3 of the world's goods and consumes about 1/10 of global production. So there's a real mismatch there. And then the other issue, which I guess we will probably talk about in greater detail, is China's support for Russia's defense industry and essentially enabling it not only to continue to prosecute the war in Ukraine, but to reconstitute its ability to produce defense equipment, weapons that will pose a growing threat to Europe going forward. And this is something that that Blinken said very clearly, that China is fueling the greatest threat to Europe since the end of World War II. And interestingly, I heard that the Chinese pushed back You know, they claim that Russia's a great country. They're making progress themselves. China isn't really the source of all of the progress that they have made. But of course, Blinken did lay down a very clear red line and said, if the Chinese don't take action, we will. And of course, we have since seen sanctions announced not only on Chinese entities, but also on Russian entities. We have not yet seen actions taken against Chinese banks, although that could be coming. So ultimately, I think the U.S.-China relationship is in a place of sort of fragile stability. The Chinese are facing real economic headwinds. Xi Jinping is focused on domestic issues. And I think there's a widely held view among observers that Xi Jinping really wants to have a degree of predictability and stability in the U.S.-China relationship. And the way I heard it from some people who went on the trip with Blinken, that the Chinese that they met with from the top down or the bottom up almost seemed to be pleading that the United States and China should be partners, they should cooperate. So they really, at this juncture, want to continue to have a stable relationship.
So I think that definitely the dual use goods issues is a really important conversation in the transatlantic context, Bonnie. So could you just say a little bit more about your interpretation or your understanding of China's motivations? Why is it doing this? I mean, I think that there was hope at some point that China would be a little bit more cautious or maybe not so forward leaning with the extent of stuff that they're sending, because now the list is quite extensive. I mean, we're talking about jet engine parts, all of the component pieces that Russia needs to make explosives, obviously the chips and semiconductors and other things. But I've also heard even satellite imagery that Russia can then use to hit targets inside Ukraine. So, I mean, they're doing it. I mean, there's quite a lot there. And I think the hope was that they wouldn't be so forward leaning in their support for Russia because of the risk of jeopardizing Europe. And yet that doesn't quite seem to be limiting them to that great of an extent. So what, just say a little bit from Beijing's perspective, what the calculus is in their willingness to continue to support Russia's war in Ukraine.
The data shows in 2022 that the Chinese transferred very little to Russia. This really began in 2023. And a great deal of capability was transferred in 2023. And I think the only way that at least I can assess what the Chinese were driven by was that they calculated that they could get away with it, that the US and Europe believed that the bar was transferring lethal aid, probably a major weapon system, and that anything below that bar they would be able to transfer without any consequences. And for the entire year, last year, I think that was basically true. And then the United States and Europe, I think, started to amass a great deal of evidence that it was not just components. It was more significant dual-use products. And as you mentioned, satellite imagery. And I think that there was an assessment by the U.S. intelligence community that the Russian defense industry essentially had been completely reconstituted, and it was almost completely due to Chinese aid. And so I think that the U.S. then went back and gave these very tough messages to China, beginning, I think, with President Biden's phone call last fall with Xi Jinping. And, you know, the Chinese just haven't really taken it very seriously. So we'll see how they react to these latest sanctions. We will see if they cut back on these deliveries. But at least from the messages that they give to, at least from the messages they gave to Secretary Blinken, it seems to me that they aren't even acknowledging that what they're doing is a problem.
Yeah. I mean, and as you said, I mean, the U.S. is clearly taking it seriously, and Blinken had some pretty firm words, as you said, Bonnie, if China doesn't address the problem, we will. No, I'm going to turn to you because that message doesn't, or that seriousness or the same alarm doesn't seem to be characterizing all parts of Europe. And in particular, I'm thinking of the Germans. And it was really notable, as you covered in your newsletter, that NATO Secretary General Scholz traveled to Beijing. NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg traveled to Beijing just after Scholz's visit and seemed to feel the need to try to insert some urgency or deliver a wake-up call, basically saying that, hey, look, this is what China's doing. They're trying to have it both ways. We can't allow them. So how are some of our European allies viewing this issue that seems to be like, I mean, one of three priorities perhaps for the visit to China, so clearly at the top of the US list, but is Europe seeing it the same way?
I think it depends, Andrea, where who you talk to. I think there's a great deal of concern in Brussels about this at the European Commission. They have put several Chinese entities on their sanctions list, and that doesn't mean that these companies are sanctioned. It just means that European companies are being told not to do business with them. But there is a debate, I think, at G7 level about moving to a more robust sanctions. And Yellen talked about this when she was in China several weeks ago. Blinken has talked very very loudly about this. I think it was striking that during the Scholz visit, of course, this came up. He was asked by journalists about dual-use technologies that were making it from China into Russia. But his public comments on this were very mild, I thought. You know, he did not say this is something that is a serious concern for us or anything like that. Now, we don't know what he said behind closed doors to Xi Jinping. He spent I think over 3 hours with the Chinese president, the tradition in Germany, certainly under Angela Merkel and Scholz, now appears to be continuing this approach, has been to give tough messages in private and to not criticize publicly. But we don't know what Scholz said, and I think this is a really tough one for Europe and especially for Germany, because I think moving from putting a few Chinese entities on a list to more robust sanctions, that will create a sort of escalatory dynamic, I think, that the Germans are very worried about, and we can get into the broader trade relationship between Europe and China and the trade tensions perhaps a bit later. But my sense is that in Berlin right now, there's real concern about dual-use goods making it from China into Russia. But there's also a great deal of concern about responding in a very robust way. I think the way that the U.S., certainly the way Yellen and Blinken have been describing it, sanctioning Chinese banks and all that, there is a great deal of fear in Berlin at the moment about Chinese retaliation on a number of levels.
Thanks again for coming on our show. And this has been very, very interesting. And I'm wondering how in Beijing are these threats of sanctions, whether it's banks, et cetera, how are those received? Is this something that really resonates within a lot of the offices in Beijing, where this is something that they are really concerned about? Or is there a feeling that they can circumvent those? That actually this sounds worse than it really is. In other words, I think the Russian experience has been that over time they can get around sanctions. The sanctions don't scare Moscow. And Beijing, I'm wondering what their response is to this. Will they actually roll back some of their assistance? Or do you think that they're going to be saying, look, go ahead, sanction us. We don't care. We're moving forward on this. You need us more than we need you anyway. You know, something like that.
If the Chinese were to curb some of their support for Russia, I think it would be a result of an assessment at the highest level that Xi Jinping does not want to derail the current improvement in U.S.-China relations. It right. would not be because he's afraid of sanctions.
Right.
And I think that Xi Jinping's assessment of the need for stability is temporary and tactical in any case. And we don't know at what point he will decide that he no longer needs this stability. But yeah. I do think that the economic slowdown in China, the corruption in the PLA, other difficulties that he is facing internally have led Xi Jinping to conclude that for the time being, he wants to have a relatively stable and predictable U.S.-China relationship, at least through the end of this year, as the U.S., of course, heads into our elections. And the Chinese are trying to avoid being front and center in U.S. elections, which they are likely to fail at because so many of the local candidates at state level as well are, you know, going to talk about China. That said, I would just say that there is concern about potential sanctions on banks. And after the executive order was signed last December, reportedly, most of China's major banks just stopped these transactions with Russia because they have too much exposure to the U.S. dollar and they don't want to get shut out of the international financial community. So what we see are some of the small, medium-sized, you know, regional banks that really don't do much of their transactions in dollars continuing to support these transactions with Russia. But that's not guidance from the top. These are decisions that banks make.
Yeah.
We'll come back to the elections piece because I heard that didn't Blinken say something and the Chinese really responded to the very viscerally to the comments about interference. So, and there's obviously stuff happening on the China, on the Europe side. So I want to come back to that. But Bonnie, really quickly, just lay the groundwork from China's perspective. So sounds like generally you've described China as wanting to at least have some predictability and some stability in its relations with the US. What about when it's looking at Europe? And this is the backdrop, I think, for the Scholz visit, Macron visit, and now his visit to Europe. What is he looking to get out of these engagements?
Well, China, of course, always tries to divide our European allies from the United States. But in this case, I think they're really focused on driving wedges among the European countries. And I think they see that opportunity. Clearly, Scholz's message when he was in Beijing was much more pro-trade, not being very, very critical of some of subsidies. He clearly doesn't want to take really strong action against China and put at risk the benefits that German companies have in China. And Macron appears to favor a much more aggressive EU stance on subsidies. And he wants to increase investment into France at the same time. And of course, I think maybe that's one area where Scholz and Macron may agree. They want more Chinese investment. Clearly, the United States does not. So that's a transatlantic issue. So I think that the Chinese do want to drive wedges, and they also want to roll back to the extent that they can any very strict implementation of de-risking. You know, this has been problematic from China's perspective from the beginning. They have never bought into the fact that de-risking really differs from decoupling, and they think that it will hamper their own ability to get their economy moving again, and more importantly, to dominate technology going forward. And Xi Jinping's concept of achieving this target of national rejuvenation by the middle of the century really is dependent on dominating these really core areas of technology and semiconductors. That he already faces a great deal, of course, of restrictions from the United States and from Europe, but other areas, great potential going forward. What's going to happen on quantum computing, and will there be restrictions on outbound investment? These are things we're still talking about, but we really haven't made decisions on. So I think he'd like to influence thinking on that, and he ultimately wants to drive the message of our areas of commonality are greater than our areas of difference.
Noah, I want to flip it over to you for the European perspective and get your take on the Scholz visit and then what you expect to come out of the Putin-Macron visit that's coming up. How do you think they might be similar, but how do you think that they'll be different?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting because a year ago, Macron went to China, had a very warm and fuzzy meeting with Xi Jinping that was criticized quite a bit in the media. But move, you know, fast forward a year and Macron is now in the role of tough guy in Europe. Compared to Scholz, who spent 3 days in China a couple weeks ago, as we've discussed, very, very soft messaging, public messaging on China's support for Russia, on trade, on Chinese overcapacities, the kind of messages that we've been hearing from people like Blinken and Yellen and also the European Commission. So I think this trip by Scholz surprised some people because it was so conciliatory, the tone of it. He did go with the business delegation, as German chancellors always do. But the first few days of that visit were very much focused on business ties. He didn't raise Taiwan in public once. He didn't mention human rights in public once. And he didn't mention the term de-risking, which is supposed to be at the heart of the Germany's new China strategy that it unveiled last year. So Scholz came under some criticism for this. I think the Commission and officials in France will be quite concerned about the messaging that Scholz delivered in Beijing, because the Commission is in a different place right now. It is extremely concerned about the trade relationship with China, extremely concerned about cheap Chinese goods flooding into the European market and making life very difficult for homegrown European industries, electric vehicles, but also wind, solar, and others. There is a gap, a widening gap right at the moment between Berlin on the one hand and Brussels and Paris on the other. And it's going to be very interesting. Macron has invited European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen to Paris. There is a dinner tonight between Scholz and Macron, and maybe Scholz ends up going to the meeting with Xi Jinping. Perhaps Macron can convince him. But right now, it's looking like it's going to be Macron and von der Leyen speaking with Xi Jinping and Scholz staying in Berlin. And this is quite a contrast to 5 years ago on Xi Jinping's last visit to Europe, where you had Merkel, Jean-Claude Juncker, and Macron, the European Commission and the French and German leaders together, sending a message of European unity. So we'll see if Scholz ends up in Paris. If he doesn't go, I think that will be a pretty damaging signal about how united Europe is in the current situation.
Thanks very much for that. And I just want to have a quick follow-up question. You know, you're right about the Macron visit last year. It was really criticized in Washington particularly, but in other parts of Europe too. And a lot of the things that Macron said on the plane coming back from Beijing to the press, if you remember, he made some statements that really were, you know, not real well received. So here's a year later, Macron's going to see him. I'm wondering if we've got to, if this, I wonder what the difference is going to be in terms of atmosphere in that meeting, in the sense that, you know, Macron gave that speech just a few days ago at the Sorbonne. And I haven't read this transcript, but it was in tone, a very urgent warning to Europe about the threats coming to Europe and the need to be able to stand on its own feet and not be dependent on the U.S. and to be a third way. So he struck some of those same notes, but you would think, given that kind of a new tough guy Macron, as you mentioned, certainly towards Russia, and a Macron that wants to be seen as a strong leader during this time of threat in Europe, that that he won't quite be as glib as he was a year ago, or am I wrong? And really, meeting with Xi is a sign of this standing on your own feet, this independence, and you know, what do you think is going to be that difference that we're going to really see with this visit coming up versus what we saw a year ago with Macron?
Well, I think you know, this is Xi is coming to Paris because it's the 60th anniversary of relations between France and the People's Republic of China. So there is going to be a degree of ceremony. There is going to be some red carpets. And Macron, after meeting Xi in Paris, is going to take him to the Pyrenees Mountains, where his beloved grandmother Manette lived, and he spent childhood vacation. So he's mixing the personal with the substance. I think Paris will be more about substance, and then he will go to the Pyrenees with Xi, accompanied by both of their wives, and that will be that will send perhaps a bit of a different signal. You recall, Jim, that there was a bit of this when Macron was in China, Xi and Macron sitting there drinking tea, listening to music and all that. So Macron is reciprocating, and he does like to mix this personal, you know, whether it's Trump or Xi Jinping, he's done this in the past. It's going to be interesting. I think the key issue here, I don't think there's a huge difference between France and Germany on Ukraine. I mean, there are nuances between the two, but I think they're both very worried about China's sort of creeping support for Russia. I believe there is a sense both in Berlin and Paris that after kind of brushing up against the red lines in terms of what Russia was what China was delivering to Russia, China is beginning to cross those lines and test Europe and the United States. But on trade, I think there is a fundamental difference right now. France is very supportive of the European Commission, which has launched this anti-subsidy investigation into imports of electric vehicles from China. It is very supportive of all the other measures that the European Commission has taken. It has made great use just in the past couple months of its new foreign subsidies regulation, which allows it to go after foreign companies in the European market that are benefiting from subsidies at home and distorting the market in Europe. So Commission has launched some big investigations into Chinese train companies, solar, wind, and I think most prominently recently launched a raid on Nuketech, which is a Chinese security equipment company in both Poland and the Netherlands. This is also using this foreign subsidies regulation. So they're accusing Nuketech of benefiting from subsidies and distorting the market in Europe. But this is also a company where there are a lot of security concerns about. So Commission is using tools, subsidy tool, to go after a company which is raising security concerns. And this is a very aggressive approach. Germany is very worried about this turning into a tit for tat, turning into a situation both on the EV investigation and all these other tools that the Commission is using, a situation where China is going to retaliate against Europe, and not just against French cognac, as it has threatened to do, but also against German car makers. And that was very clear on the Scholz trip. Of course, all the big car makers were with him on that trip. And he made very clear in his public comments that he doesn't want this trade relationship between Europe and China to go off the rails and China to be retaliating against German companies. A lot of concern about that in Berlin.
Bonnie, how do you think Beijing is seeing this? I mean, it's a convoluted, complicated picture. So on the one hand, there is some daylight between Macron and Scholz on their willingness to take a hard line on the trade front. And then with Macron too, I think in the Sorbonne speech, he warned about both protectionism from both China, but also the United States. And so I wonder how seriously Beijing takes all of this, or whether or not there's just so many kind of wedges or fissures in the overall picture that they think they can exploit to ultimately weaken the pressure that Europe is going to be able to mount against China in the trade realm. Like, are they taking this seriously, do you think, from Beijing's perspective?
I do think the Chinese are watching very closely how the Commission is using its new trade and investigative tools. There's been probably a lot more progress over the last year of the Commission applying these tools. And it began with the, I think, anti-coercion instrument. And I think there's now maybe another four or five tools. And I think that the Chinese are probably a little bit on their back foot as they ask themselves, how far is this going to go? And is there a way that they can slow this down or even reverse it? I tend to think that the differences, whether they're between European countries or between the United States and Europe, they tend to work to Beijing's benefit. That China just wants to prevent coalitions of countries organizing against them. And I will cite as one example that when Secretary of State Blinken was in China, the issue that Foreign Minister Wang Yi was most irritated by, I heard, was the U.S.-Japan-Philippines meeting, the leaders, which of course is just one example of these coalitions, trilaterals and quadrilaterals that the United States has been forging really over the last 4 years. They've really taken off. So I think that to the extent that the Chinese can drive those wedges, they would like to do so. And I also think that to some extent, the Chinese will wait out any strong response to the United States, and because they'll see what'll happen with our elections at the end of the year.
Perfect segue to elections, which I was hoping we would have time to get to. So obviously the U.S. election coming up, but even before that, the EU elections. There's been quite a few stories, Noah, I think, about Chinese individuals being arrested on allegations of spying for China. Bonnie, talk to us a little bit about what China is doing and what you expect their approach to be. You can focus on the U.S. election if you want, but how do you think that they're going to be approaching this election? Should we all be prepared for perhaps more brazen tactics than we've seen from China in the past?
Well, I've recently watched the Taiwan elections, which took place on January 13th, and the Chinese did use some new tactics. And people often say that Taiwan is a testbed for new forms of disinformation, misinformation. One thing in particular was the generation of deep fakes using AI. And there were images of Taiwan's president as well as the president-elect, who will now be inaugurated on May 20th, William Lai, saying things that, of course, neither one of them said. And so I think that that's one thing to be really quite concerned about. In Taiwan, we saw a lot of direct, I think, election interference, but I doubt that we will see as much in the United States. The Chinese will always try to shape the narrative. They might even try to use relationships that they have at local levels to influence the outcome of maybe some of the congressional elections. When it comes to the presidency, I actually think that the Chinese are a bit torn. In the past, many people in China really thought that getting a second Trump administration would be great for them because he's transactional and they can cut a deal and they can always use their relationship with North Korea to try to get Trump to lay off of further pressure on them on trade. But that was the old playbook, and things are very different today. And after COVID hit the world and turned into a pandemic, Trump really took on a much harsher stance toward China. And the Chinese fully believe that if he comes back to power, he will be Trump too. He will not be the friendlier Trump that just wanted to cut a deal on trade. And then I would add to that this layer of the meetings between Xi Jinping and Biden and the achievement of this relative sort of fragile stability at a time when China faces these really strong economic headwinds. I think they want more predictability. They want the stability. And so I think they now tend to see, at least the majority, it's probably no consensus, but I think the majority of people really actually would prefer to see a Biden second term, even though they don't like the fact that he is building these coalitions against China.
To what, really quick follow-up, and then I want to hear about what's happening in the European space, but to what extent, I mean, there are some tactics that would be used to try to sway an election, increase the odds that one or another candidate is elected, but then also what we see quite a bit from Russia also are just efforts to undermine faith in electoral processes, undermine faith in the outcome of the election, just the really kind of disruptive tactics that are intended to weaken the United States, its credibility as a democratic leader, et cetera. To what extent is Beijing interested in that kind of portfolio of actions?
Well, what I'm particularly concerned about is the extent to which China is working together with Russia and how they might actually come together to influence the U.S. elections. There is a new article out that suggests that there is evidence of China and Russia collaborating on disinformation and information manipulation in the elections in the Solomon Islands. And many Russia experts have argued over the last few years that maybe Russia and China are learning from each other. They're amplifying each other's messages, but there is no hard evidence, so people said, of them actually working together. And I have remained very skeptical as to whether or not that maybe the evidence just wasn't there, because the trend of China's relationship with Russia is so clear. They are cooperating in lots of new areas. And we see more taking place, for example, in the Arctic, where Russia's interests are probably really not advanced by having more Chinese influence. So I think that there probably is greater cooperation between them. And I think that we need to look for more evidence and be wary of maybe that they will undertake those kind of efforts in our elections this year.
Noah, how concerned are Europeans about Chinese influence? Obviously, Russia grabs a lot of the headlines, and there's been so many revelations about Russian paying particular candidates and France uncovering all of these Russian information operations. But as I alluded before, there were these arrests of potential Chinese spies. How are people, to what's your sense of how Europeans are thinking about the risks of Chinese influence, particularly in the run-up to the EU election?
Well, I think there's a great deal of concern about it. I think the main concern is about the Russians. And as you said, there is a precedent for that. The Russians are more brazen and have tried to interfere in past elections. But the arrests of these spies, specifically the parliamentary assistant to a European parliamentarian, Maximilian Krah, who is the lead candidate in the European elections for the Alternative for Germany, the far-right, leading far-right party in Germany. This is really gotten a lot of attention. I think there's, I think the realization that China could interfere, that China is establishing relationships with parties like the AfD, but not just far right parties. It's other parties as well, established parties. This is beginning to come home. I think if you go back to the last European election 5 years ago, nobody would have been talking about Chinese interference. But that is, I think, increasingly a concern this time. China and Russia working together, as Bonnie says, is a big concern. I think the big question, if we're looking at sort of China policy, Ursula von der Leyen, the European Commission president, has really driven European-China policy over the past year. And she's a candidate again, but it will depend on the election result, whether she remains at the top of the European Commission. And there are some games being played at the moment. There have been reports in recent weeks that Macron was sounding out the Italian Prime Minister Meloni about whether Mario Draghi, the former European Central Bank president, might be interested in the job. I think in the end, Ursula von der Leyen has a good chance of remaining in place because I think the center right will do quite well in the elections. But if she doesn't, you know, we're gonna have a shift in Europe's policy towards China because she has put a lot of policies on track over the past few years. We talked about all the tools that the Commission now has. She launched an economic security strategy last year. And so this agenda depends to a certain extent on whether she remains in the European Commission. So I would say if the Chinese are maybe undecided on whether Trump or Biden would be better, I think they're very, very certain that they would prefer Ursula von der Leyen to be out of the European Commission come later this year.
Well, thank you very much. Let me go back to our election and just to ask a very basic question. But based on your experience watching how Russia and particularly China, how they interfere with elections in Europe, you know, what we've seen to date. Bonnie talked about what happened in Taiwan and the new tactics that you saw there in China. What will it look like to see Russia and China working together to influence the U.S. election, the presidential election? I mean, there's the standard stuff we all know, you know, social media, et cetera, but you know, deep fakes. But I mean, is there something specific or something that is truly the tactic that China or China-Russia would do that we should kind of look for, that we should brace ourselves for? Or really, will it be just more of the same kind of stuff? You'll see stuff on Twitter, you know, deep fake or whatever. And but you know, I ask this because, you know, we talk about their interference in our elections and this type of thing, but I'm just wondering, what does it really look like? What would we see?
Is that a question for me, Jim?
Sure. And then Bonnie, based on your Taiwan experience.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not an expert on election interference, but I would say, you know, the Chinese will want to keep a distance to, unlike the Russians, where it's very easy to see what they're doing. I think the Chinese will want to keep this all at arm's length. So I think we're talking about state-backed organizations using social media, the kind of hybrid tactics that and influencing tactics that we see, that we probably see that Taiwan is very used to by now. I'm not sure if China is at the point where they're ready to sort of, you know, adopt full Russian tactics, which I think are much more aggressive. I don't know, Bonnie, what you think.
Well, I think that it's challenging to predict. I agree with you, Noah, that the Chinese do not want to be seen as in a very direct way, like Russia might do. They don't want to be caught red-handed.
No fingerprints.
Right. They don't want to leave any fingerprints. But I do think what people are worried about is how artificial intelligence can be used going forward to interfere in politics and in elections. I think this is what in general intelligence agencies are concerned about. And so, yes, deep fakes is one example, but maybe there are new ways to use AI going forward that China would be able to cover up its identity, but might be able to be more effective in its messaging. So I don't know exactly what that would look like. But I think something the United States is also particularly concerned about is that the Chinese are using disinformation and other sort of information manipulation techniques to send out this message that the U.S. Is chaotic. Our democracy has failed. Our entire system has failed. And I think that that has a really corrosive effect on our electorate. When people just say, oh, look, why should I even go to the polls and vote? Because it's not going to make a difference. And, you know, everybody is corrupt, or the government isn't going to help me. And maybe they will try to do other things to protect their own interests that are outside of the law.
Right.
So it could just contribute to a process, I think, of undermining our democracy.
Right, right. Good point.
Yeah. Okay. I know we're at time. Bonnie, will you indulge me for one final question? So
yes.
One thing I've been thinking about writing about is this notion of opportunistic aggression. And if something happened in the Indo-Pacific, if there was some sort of Taiwan contingency, that might be the moment that Putin is really tempted to do something to directly test NATO. And we can think about that. My question to you is, what's your sense of Xi's thinking on Taiwan at the moment? And how, I mean, I know, yes, it's difficult to predict and I understand all of that, but how do you think he's thinking about that issue? I mean, obviously there's these warnings out there. It's going to be, what is it, 2027, or I don't know what the date is, but how do you read what his intentions are vis-a-vis Taiwan at the moment?
If you examine some data points, for example, Xi Jinping's recent meeting with former Taiwan President Ma Ying-jeou when he traveled to China last month, and if you read the work conference reports from the Taiwan Affairs Office conference, the Taiwan Affairs Work Conference earlier this year, what you see is a Chinese emphasis on this strategy of integrated development, trying to promote more economic integration. They're talking more about giving Taiwanese the benefits of China's growth. And I by no means think that this is a strategy that is going to work, but the Chinese themselves are emphasizing more the peaceful part of their offer. Xi Jinping is talking about the Chinese nation, and less about one country, two systems, for example, but wants this incoming president to talk about how the two sides of the strait are part of the same sort of Chinese nation. They share culture. So he has softened his tone at the same time that, of course, he continues to develop his military and engages in coercion against Taiwan. And I would cite that at the end of February, for the first time, three Chinese Coast Guard ships actually entered the 24 nautical mile line, the contiguous zone around Taiwan proper, the main island. And that remarkably has received very little media attention. So my view is that, again, because of economic headwinds, because of corruption in the military, because of Xi Jinping's understanding about the war in Ukraine that wasn't, it did not go as Russia had hoped it to. It did not go as Russia hoped that it would. But of course, it has turned the tide in Moscow's direction nonetheless. But it's not an easy victory. And it has come at a very high cost for Russia, a cost that China does not want to face. So my view is, and I think that there are people in the administration who have pretty much said as much, is that a near-term invasion of Taiwan or even use of force against Taiwan is unlikely unless the new president actually decides to poke a finger in China's eye and do something that is really seen as trying to push ahead this agenda of legal independence. And I think that's highly unlikely because the new president wants to focus on domestic issues, I'm told, in his first couple of years in office. And he wants to strengthen ties with the international community and, of course, particularly the United States. And all of that will be off the realm of the possible if he does pursue something that is provocative. So I think 2027, the most important thing everybody should know about that date, is it is the 100th anniversary, the centenary of the PLA. So we will see a big parade in Beijing. But I don't think we are going to see use of force against Taiwan in 2027.
All right. I love to end on a good news story. That was wonderful. This whole conversation was really wonderful. It's been a little while since we've caught up on the China-Europe relationship. And this, I think, hopefully listeners, I feel caught up. So hopefully listeners do too. So thanks to both of you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Brussels Sprouts, brought to you by the Transatlantic Security Team at the Center for a New American Security. You can find all of our previous episodes wherever you get your podcasts. And please remember to rate and review Brussels Sprouts so that new listeners are able to find the show.